that would let me electronically march right into a company's network. The rush I'd felt back in the days when I was known in the online underworld as Condor, my hacker handle. I had originally chosen that name out of admiration for a character who was a particular hero of mine, the one step ahead of everybody guy played by Robert Redford in the movie 3 Days of the Condor. And now the probation department had assigned me a new probation officer, somebody who seemed to think I had gotten too many breaks and needed to be taught some lessons. He had called up a company that was in the process of hiring me and asked questions like, "Will Kevin have access to company funds?" even though I had never made a penny from hacking, despite how easy it would have been. That pissed me off. I got the job anyway, but every day before I left, they searched me for external media like floppy disks and mag tapes. Just me. Nobody else. I hated that. After 5 months, I completed a huge programming assignment and was laid off. I wasn't sorry to leave. But finding a new job proved a challenge, since the same probation officer kept calling every prospective employer and asking those alarming questions of his. Will he have access to any financial information? And so on. That left me depressed as well as unemployed. The 2 or 3 hours a day that I spent at the gym stretched my muscles, but not my mind. I signed up for a computer programming class and a nutrition class because I was trying to learn more about living a healthy lifestyle at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. In my first week there, I powered the workstation off and on while constantly typing Control-C, which broke the computer out of its boot-up script and gave me administrative privileges, or root. Minutes later, an administrator came running into the room, shouting, "What are you doing?" I smiled at him. I found a bug, and look, I got root. He ordered me out and told my probation officer I had been on the internet, which wasn't true, but gave them enough of an excuse to force me to pack up and drop out of all programming classes. Years later, I would learn that a system admin at the university had sent a message to a guy by the name of Tsutomu Shimomura under the subject line, "About our friend," describing this incident. Shimomura figures heavily in the final chapters of this story, but I was stunned when I discovered that he had been snooping into what I was up to as early as this, at a time when we had had no contact and I didn't even know he existed. Though booted from the programming course at UNLV, I aced the nutrition class, then switched to Clark County Community College, where tuition was cheaper for residents. This time I took courses in advanced electronics, as well as a writing course. Classes might have been more of an attraction if the girl students had been pretty enough or lively enough to get my juices flowing a little faster, but this was community college night school. If I wanted to meet more showgirls, it wasn't going to be in a classroom at night. When depressed, I turn to things that give me pleasure. Doesn't everyone? With Eric, something interesting had dropped into my lap. Something that might offer a much greater test of my abilities. Something that might get my adrenaline pumping again. The hard truth is that there wouldn't be any story to tell if I hadn't overcome my unhappiness about Lewis and filled him in on my conversation with Eric. He was all for it, eager to sound out this guy and see if he seemed to be on the level. Lewis phoned me back the next day to say that he had contacted Spiegel and talked to Eric. He seemed surprised to admit he had liked the guy. Even more, he agreed with me that Eric, as he put it, seems to know a lot of stuff about Pacific Bell's internal processes and switches. He could be a valuable resource. Lewis thought we ought to get together with him. I was about to play the first move of what would turn into an elaborate cat-and-mouse game, one that would put me at high risk and demand every ounce of my ingenuity. Part 2. Eric. 11. Foul Play. Early in January 1992, my father called from Los Angeles to say he was worried about my half-brother, Adam, his only other child. I had always been envious of Adam's relationship with our father, since I had seen my dad only intermittently in the first years of my growing up. Adam had been living with our dad in Calabasas, near Los Angeles, while he took a pre-law program at Pierce College. He hadn't come home the night before, which my father said wasn't like him. I tried to offer reassurance, but what could I say when I really didn't know anything about the situation? Dad's concern turned out to be appropriate. For several miserable days, he was beside himself at hearing no word from Adam. I tried to console and reassure him while I made anxious calls to Uncle Mitchell and Adam's friend Kent and paged Adam himself over and over and over. A few days later, my dad called, sobbing and distraught. He had just gotten a phone call from the police. They had found Adam in the passenger seat of his car, parked at a major druggie hangout, Echo Park. He was dead of a drug overdose. Though Adam and I had grown up separately in different cities except for a short period when we both lived with our father in Atlanta, in the last couple of years we had grown very close, half-brothers who had become closer than many blood brothers. When I had first started getting to know him in Los Angeles, I couldn't stand any of the music he cared about, rap and hip-hop, anything by Two Life Crew, Dr. Dre, or N.W.A. But the more of it I heard when we were together, the more it grew on me, and music became part of the bond that drew us to each other. And now he was gone. My father and I had had an up-and-down relationship, but I felt he needed me now. I got in touch with my probation officer and gained permission to return to L.A. for a time to help my dad cope with Adam's death and work his way out of the depression he seemed to be in, even though I knew that this would heighten my own sadness. A day later, I was in my car heading west on I-15 out of the desert for the 5-hour pull to Los Angeles. The drive gave me time to think. Adam's death just didn't seem to make sense. Like a lot of kids, he had gone through a rebellious period. At one point, he had dressed to emulate his favorite goth bands and was really embarrassing to even be seen with in public. He wasn't getting along with our dad at all then and had moved in with my mom and me for a while. But more recently, in college, he seemed to have found himself. Even if he used drugs recreationally, it just didn't make sense to me that he would have overdosed. I had seen him recently, and there hadn't been anything in his behavior that even hinted at his being an addict. And my dad had told me that the cops hadn't found any needle marks when they discovered Adam's body. Driving into the night to join my father, I began to think about whether I might be able to use my hacking skills to find out who Adam had been with that night and where he had been. Late in the evening, after the dull drive from Las Vegas, I pulled up at my dad's apartment on Las Virgenes Road in the town of Calabasas, about 45 minutes up the coast from Santa Monica and a dozen miles inland from the ocean. I found him absolutely devastated about Adam, harboring a suspicion of foul play. The normal routine of Dad's life, running his general contracting business, watching the TV news, reading the newspaper over breakfast, taking trips to the Channel Islands to go boating, going to occasional synagogue services, was torn apart. I knew my moving in with him would pose challenges. He was never an easy man to deal with. But I wasn't going to let that stand in my way. He needed me. When he opened the door to greet me, I was shocked by how distraught he looked, how gray his face was. He was an emotional wreck. Balding now, clean-shaven, and of medium build, he seemed suddenly shrunken. The cops had already told him, "This isn't the kind of case we investigate." But they had found that Adam's shoes were tied as if by a person facing him, not the way he would have tied them by himself, and closer examination had revealed one needle puncture in his right arm, which would make sense only if someone else had given him the fatal dose. He was right-handed, so it would have been entirely unnatural for him to inject himself using his left hand. It was clear he had been with someone else when he died, someone who had given him the fatal hit, either bad dope or way too much, then dumped his body in his car, driven it to a seedy, drug-infested part of Los Angeles, and split. If the cops weren't going to do anything, I would have to be the vigilante investigator. I took over Adam's old room and dived into researching the phone company records. My best guesses were the two people I had been calling when I first heard from Dad, Adam's closest friend, Kent, whom he was supposed to be with on his last weekend, and, unhappily, my Uncle Mitchell, who had already destroyed his own life with dope. Adam had become very close to Uncle Mitchell. My dad had a hunch that Mitchell had played a role in Adam's death, maybe even been responsible for it. At the funeral, the viewing took place in a separate room. I went in alone and found Adam laid out in an open coffin. Being at the funeral of someone close to me was a new and emotionally difficult experience. I remember how different he looked. Unrecognizable. I just kept hoping that I was trapped in some sort of cruel nightmare. I was alone in a room with my only brother, and I would never again be able to speak with him. It's a cliche, I know, but my sadness made me realize how little time we really have in this life. One of my first tasks in L.A. was to contact the probation officer to whom my case had been transferred, Frank Gulla. Late 40-ish, with a medium build and a friendly, calm personality, he was even relaxed about the rules. For example, not insisting on our required monthly visits after he got to know me. When I would finally get around to showing up at his office, he'd have me fill out the monthly reports that I had missed, and we'd backdate them. I don't suppose he was that lax with guys charged with more serious crimes, but I appreciated his being so casual with me. I threw myself into the investigation. Dad and I both suspected Adam's friend Kent knew more than he was telling us. Was he perhaps relieving his conscience by opening up to other people? If so, was he careless enough to do it over the telephone? With my friend Alex, I drove to Long Beach, where Kent lived. After a little snooping at a nearby apartment complex, I found what I needed, a phone line not currently wired to the phone of any customer. One call to the local CO was all it took to get a tech to punch down a connection from Kent's line to the unused phone line, turning it, in effect, into a secret extension of his phone. Alex and I set up a voice-activated tape recorder inside the phone company's terminal box to capture every word spoken on both ends of Kent's calls. For the next several days, I made the hour-and-a-half trek from my dad's place to the apartment building with the hidden recorder in Long Beach. Each time I'd retrieve the previous day's tape, replace it with a fresh one, and pop the microcassette into my portable tape player to listen to Kent's conversations as I drove back to Dad's. In vain. Hours and hours of effort and nothing to show for it. Meanwhile, I was also piecing together a picture of people Uncle Mitchell had been talking to in the hours before Adam's death. I was able to social engineer employees at Pactel Cellular and get his call detail records, hoping these would show me whether Mitchell had been making calls one after another, suggesting a sense of urgency or panic, or calls to other friends he might have been asking for help. Nothing. I tried Pactel Cellular again, hoping to find out which cell phone sites Mitchell's calls had been relayed through, which might show whether he had been near Echo Park, where Adam's body had been abandoned. But I couldn't find anyone who knew how to access the records I wanted. Either Pactel wasn't storing that data, or I just wasn't managing to find the people who knew which system had access to the database it was in and how to retrieve it. All in a good but ultimately worthless cause, I had slipped back into my full-blown hacker way of life. My road had come to a dead end. I had tried every tactic I knew and gotten nowhere. I didn't have much more insight into Adam's death than I'd had when my father first called me about it. I was angry and frustrated, miserable at not being able to give my father and myself the satisfaction of having discovered at least some morsels of useful information. Closure to this sad episode would come only many years later. My dad stopped talking to Mitchell, convinced he was responsible for Adam's death. The two brothers would not speak to each other again until the very end of my father's life when he was suffering the ravages of lung cancer. As I write this, Uncle Mitchell has just died. At the family gathering, one of his ex-wives took me aside. In embarrassment, she said, "I've been wanting to tell you this for a long time. Mitchell wasn't a nice man. The night that Adam died, Mitchell called me. He was so upset I could hardly understand him. He said he and Adam had been shooting up together and Adam had gotten too big a dose and keeled over. Mitchell panicked. He shook Adam, he put him in the shower, but nothing helped. He called me to ask for help. I refused to be involved, so he called a drug dealer he knew, who helped get Adam's shoes on and carry the body into Adam's car. They drove in two cars to Echo Park, left Adam dead in his car, and drove away." So my father had been right all along. Instead of calling 911, Mitchell had sacrificed a nephew he loved to save his own neck. I can feel myself getting angry again as I tell this. I had believed all along that Mitchell was somehow involved, yet now, hearing the truth, I felt sick to my stomach, that he had been capable of such a thing, and that he had died without ever admitting it. This man, whom I had loved and respected and looked up to, had not been able, even on his deathbed, to tell me the truth. 12. You can never hide. I had become so wrapped up in investigating Adam's death that I needed a break, something else to focus my attention on that wasn't so emotional. For me, the diversion I needed wasn't hard to find. I would go back and tackle Neil Clift, the Brit who had been finding all the security holes in Dex's VMS operating system. How could I trick him into giving me all the security bugs he had found? From messages I had been reading, I knew that Clift had long craved a job at Dex. Maybe that could be my opening. I duped British Telecom into giving me his unlisted home telephone number and called him, introducing myself as Daryl Piper, the name of an actual digital software engineer in VMS development. I told him, "We've got a hiring freeze right now, but despite that, we may be hiring some security engineers. Your name came up because you've been so helpful in finding security vulnerabilities and sharing them with us." And I went on to talk to him about some deck manuals I knew he wanted. At the end of the call, I said, "Well, nice talking to you. It's been a long time." Oops, big mistake. The two men had never spoken before. Later, I would learn that Neil called well-known security consultant Ray Kaplan, who he knew had interviewed me on his Meet the Enemy conference series. Ray played a portion of the tape. Neil had to listen for only a few moments before confirming. "Yes, the guy who called me was Kevin Mitnick. The next time we spoke, Ray told me, 'I guess you're still doing some social engineering.' Confused, I asked, 'What do you mean?' 'Neil called me. I played a piece of the interview I did with you. He recognized your voice and said you've been calling him.'" Of course, all this time, I was also still in contact with Eric Hines, who kept bringing up Kevin Poulsen's name. I had never met Poulsen, but had read enough and heard enough to admire his hacking achievements. It was strange that we had never met, never hacked together, because we were close to the same age and had grown up just a few miles apart. He would later explain that he started learning about phone phreaking sometime after I did. I was already famous in the hacker community when he was still a neophyte. Lewis and I were both eager to find out more from Eric about what he and Poulsen had been doing together. In one phone conversation, Eric again rattled off the names of Pacific Bell systems he and Poulsen had gained control over. The list was familiar, all except one that I had never heard of. SAS. "What's SAS?" I asked. "It's an internal testing system that can be used to monitor a line. In phone company lingo, monitor is a tactful word for wiretap." I told Eric, "With switch access, you can monitor a line any time." I figured he'd understand. The phone company's 1A ESS switches had a talk and monitor feature that let you pop in on a line and listen to the conversation. Eric said, "SAS is better." He claimed that he and Poulsen had made a nighttime visit to the Sunset Central office in West Hollywood, but their visit had turned up some things they hadn't seen before. They found the place strange. Unlike other COs, it was equipped with unusual computer terminals and tape drives, looking like something from an alien planet. One refrigerator-sized box had various types of equipment humming inside it. They came across a manual identifying the device as a Switched Access Services Unit, SAS for short. When Poulsen started leafing through the manual, he realized that SAS was meant for line testing, which sounded like it meant you could connect onto any phone line. But was it just for checking that the line was working, or could you pick up conversations? Poulsen started fiddling with the SAS control terminal, punching in the number of a payphone he sometimes used. He confirmed that, yes, you could drop in on a line and hear the conversation. He went back into the CO on another night with a tape recorder so he could capture the data being sent out from the SAS equipment. He wanted to try to reverse engineer the protocol at home and give himself the same capabilities. I had to have access to this system, but when I asked for details, Eric clammed up and quickly changed the subject. I started researching it the very next day. The mysterious SAS was just what I had been lacking in my life, a puzzle to be solved, an adventure with hazards. It was unbelievable that in my years of phone freaking, I had never heard about it. Intriguing. I felt, wow, I gotta figure this out. From my earlier nocturnal visits to phone company offices, as well as reading every telephone company manual I could get my hands on, and social engineering phone company employees since I was in high school, I had a well-developed knowledge of the different departments, processes, procedures, and phone numbers within Pacific Bell. There probably weren't a lot of people inside the company who knew the structure of the working organization better than I did. I began calling various internal departments. My line was, "I'm with engineering. Does your group use SAS?" After half a dozen calls, I found a guy in an office in Pasadena who knew what I was talking about. For most people, I guess, the toughest part of a ruse like this would be figuring out a way to get hold of the desired knowledge. I wanted to know how to gain access to SAS, as well as the commands that would let me take control of it. But I wanted to go about it in a safer way than Eric and Kevin Poulsen had done. I wanted to do it without having to physically enter a Pacific Bell facility. I asked the guy in Pasadena who knew about SAS to pull a copy of the manual off the shelf for me. When he came back on the line with it, I asked him to open it up and read me the copyright notice.
The copyright notice?
Sure. That gave me the name of the company that had developed the product. But from there, I hit a snag. The company had gone out of business. The LexisNexis database maintains massive online files of old newspaper and magazine articles, legal records, and corporate material. As you might guess, the fact that a company has gone out of business doesn't mean that LexisNexis has deleted the files about it. I found the names of some individuals who had worked for the company that had developed SAS, including one of its officers. The company had been based in Northern California. I did a telephone directory search in that area and came up with the officer's phone number. He was at home when I called. I told him I was with Pacific Bell Engineering, that we wanted to make some customized improvements to our SAS infrastructure, and that I needed to talk to someone who knew the technology. He wasn't the least bit suspicious. He said it would take him a couple of minutes, then came back on the phone and gave me the name and phone number of the guy who had been the lead engineer in charge of the product development team. One more thing to do before placing the crucial phone call. At that time, Pacific Bell internal phone numbers began with the prefix 811. Anybody who had done business with the company might know that. I hacked into a Pacific Bell switch and set up an unused 811 number, then added call forwarding and forwarded it to the cloned cell phone number I was using that day. The name I gave when I called the developer was one I still remember, Marnix Van Ammers, the name of a real Pacific Bell switching engineer. I gave him the same story about needing to do some integration with our SAS units. "I've got the user's manual," I told him, "but it doesn't help for what we're trying to do. We need the actual protocols that are used between the SAS equipment in our testing centers and the central offices." I had dropped the name of an executive at his old company and was using the name of a real Pacific Bell engineer. And I didn't sound nervous. I wasn't stumbling over my words. Nothing about my call set off alarm bells. He said, "I might still have the files on my computer. Hang on." After a couple of minutes, he came back on the line. "Okay, I found them. Where do you want me to send them?" I was too impatient for that. "I'm under the gun here," I said. "Can you fax them?" He said there was too much material for him to fax the whole thing, but he could send a fax with the pages he thought would be most useful, and then mail or FedEx me a floppy with the complete files. For the fax, I gave him a phone number I knew by heart. It wasn't to a fax machine at Pacific Bell, of course, but it was in the same area code. It was the fax number for a convenient Kinko's. This was always a little risky because many machines, when they're sending a fax, display the name of the machine they're connecting to. I always worried someone would notice the tag saying Kinko's store number 267 or whatever. Dead giveaway. But as far as I can recall, no one ever did. The FedEx was almost as easy. I gave the engineer the address of those places where you could rent a mailbox and have packages held for you, and I spelled out the name of the Pacific Bell employee I was claiming to be, Marnix Van Ammers. I thanked him, and we chatted for a bit. Chatting is the kind of extra little friendly touch that leaves people with a good feeling and makes after-the-fact suspicions that much less likely. Even though I had been practicing the art of social engineering for years, I couldn't help but be amazed and a little dazzled by how easy this had been. One of those moments when you feel that runner's high, or as if you'd won a jackpot in Vegas. The endorphins are rushing through your body. That same afternoon, I drove to the mailbox rental store to set up a box in Van Amers's name. They always require ID for this. No problem, I explained. I've just moved here from Utah and my wallet was stolen. I need an address where they can mail me a copy of my birth certificate so I can get a driver's license. I'll show you the ID as soon as I get it. Yes, they were violating postal regulations by renting me a box without seeing my ID, but these places are always eager for new business. They don't really want to turn anybody away. A decent explanation is often all it takes. By that evening, I had the facts in my hands, the basic information that I hoped would allow me to wiretap any Pacific Bell phone in all of Southern California. But we still had to figure out how to use the SAS protocols. Lewis and I attacked the puzzle of trying to figure out how SAS worked from a number of different angles. The system gave a technician the ability to connect to any phone line so he could run tests to find out why a customer was hearing noise on his line or whatever the problem was. The tech would instruct SAS to dial into the particular CO that handled the telephone line to be tested. It would initiate a call to a part of the SAS infrastructure at the CO known as a Remote Access Test Point, or RATP. That was the first step. In order to hear audio on the line, voices, noise, static, or whatever, the tech would then have to establish an audio connection to the SAS unit in the CO. These units were designed with a clever security provision. They had a list of phone numbers pre-programmed into their memories. The technician would have to send a command to the SAS unit to dial back to one of the pre-programmed numbers, the phone number at the location where he was working. How could we possibly bypass such a clever, apparently infallible, security measure? Well, it turned out not to be all that hard. You'd have to be a phone company technician or a phone freaker to understand why this worked, but here's what I did. I dialed from my telephone into the phone line I knew SAS would use to make its outgoing call, then immediately triggered SAS to call back an authorized number programmed into its memory. When SAS picked up the line to make an outgoing call, it actually answered the incoming call from my phone, but it was waiting for a dial tone and couldn't get one because I had the line tied up. I went, I couldn't have hummed exactly the right sound because a dial tone in the United States is actually made up of two frequencies, but it didn't matter because the equipment wasn't designed to measure the exact frequencies. It needed only to hear some kind of hum. My Campbell's soup, was good enough. At this point, SAS attempted to dial the outgoing call, which didn't go through because I was already connected on the line it was trying to use. Final step. From my computer, I typed in cryptic commands that instructed SAS to drop in on the phone number of the subscriber line I wanted to monitor. On our first attempt, I was so excited I could barely breathe. It worked. Lewis said afterward, "Kevin, you were beside yourself dancing around in circles. It was like we had found the Holy Grail." We could remotely wiretap any phone number within all of Pacific Bell. Meanwhile, though, I was really growing antsy to find out the truth about Eric. Too many things about him seemed suspicious. He didn't appear to have a job, so how could he afford to hang out at the clubs he talked about? Hot places like Whiskey A Go-Go, where acts like Alice Cooper and The Doors, as well as rock gods from back in the day like Jimi Hendrix, had sometimes dropped in to jam. And that business about not giving me a phone number? Eric wouldn't even give me his pager number. Very suspicious. Lewis and I talked about the situation and decided we needed to find out what was going on. First step, penetrate the screen of "I won't give you my phone number." Then, once we had his phone number, use it to find his address. Caller ID wasn't being offered then to customers in California because the state's Public Utilities Commission was fretting over privacy issues and hadn't yet authorized its use. But, like most phone companies, Pacific Bell used central office switches developed by Bell Labs and manufactured by AT&T, and it was common knowledge in the freaker community that these switches already had the caller ID feature built into their software. In the building where my friend Dave Harrison had his offices, a terminal on the first floor had hundreds of phone lines running to it. I went down to the terminal in stealth mode because there was a security guard stationed very nearby, though thankfully not in direct sight. Using a lineman's handset that Dave had sitting around in his office, I connected to several cable pairs, looking for one that had a dial tone. When I found one, I dialed the special code to obtain the phone number. That was the bait number I would set Eric up to call. Next, Dave punched the pair down in the terminal, connecting that line to an unused phone line running up to his office. Back upstairs, we hooked a phone to the hijacked line and connected a caller ID display box. From my old VT-100 terminal, I dialed into the Webster Street Central office switch and added the caller ID feature to the bait phone line. Later that night, I returned to my dad's apartment in Calabasas, set my alarm clock to go off at 3:30 a.m., and turned in. When the alarm went off, with my cell phone as usual cloned to someone else's number, I paged Eric, who by then had loosened up enough to give me his pager number. I left the bait phone number for him to return the call. When Eric dialed the number, the caller ID data would be sent between the first and second rings, capturing the number of his phone. Gotcha. Hermit-like, Dave secretly lived and slept in his office. As soon as I thought Eric would have returned the page, I phoned Dave. It was 3:40 in the morning. I had to keep calling until he finally answered, really angry. "What is it?" he shouted into the receiver. "Did you get the caller ID?" "Yes." "Dave, it's really important. What is it?" "Call me in the morning," he yelled before slamming the phone down. I went back to sleep and didn't reach him again until the next afternoon when he obligingly read me the phone number off the caller ID, 310-837-5412. Okay, so I had Eric's phone number. Next, to get his address. Posing as a technician in the field, I called Pacific Bell's Mechanized Loop Assignment Center, or MLAC, also known simply as the Line Assignment Office. A lady answered, and I said, "Hi, this is Terry out in the field. I need the F1 and the F2 on 310-837-5412. The F1 was the underground cable from the central office, and the F2 was the secondary feeder cable that connects a home or an office building to the serving area interface, which eventually connects to the F1 all the way back to the central office. "Terry, what's your tech code?" she asked. I knew she wasn't going to look it up. They never did. Any three-digit number would satisfy, so long as I sounded confident and didn't hesitate. 637, I said, picking a number at random. F1 is cable 23x416, binding post 416, she told me. F2 is cable 10204x36, binding post 36. Where's the terminal? The O.1 is at 3636 South Sepulveda. That was the location of the terminal box where the field technician bridged the connection to the customer's home or office. I didn't care about anything I had asked so far. It was just to make me sound legitimate. It was the next piece of information that I really wanted. "What's the sub's address?" I asked, sub being phone company lingo for the subscriber or customer. "Also 3636 South Sepulveda," she told me. "Unit 107B. I asked, "Do you have any other workers at 107B? Workers being lingo for working telephone numbers. She said, "Yes, we have one other," and gave me the second number along with its F1 and F2. As easy as that. It had taken me not much more than a few minutes to discover Eric's address and both of his phone numbers. When you use social engineering, or pretexting, you become an actor playing a role. I had heard other people try to pretext, and knew it could be painfully funny. Not everybody could go on stage and convince an audience. Not everybody could pretext and get away with it. For anyone who had mastered pretexting the way I had, though, it became as smooth as a champion bowler sending a ball down the lane. Like the bowler, I didn't expect to score a strike every time. Unlike the bowler, if I missed, I usually got another try at it with no loss of score. When you know the lingo and terminology, it establishes credibility. You're legit. A coworker slogging in the trenches, just like your targets, and they almost never question your authority. At least, they didn't back then. Why was the lady in line assignment so willing to answer all my questions? simply because I gave her one right answer and asked the right questions using the right lingo. So don't go thinking that the Pacific Bell clerk who gave me Eric's address was foolish or slow-witted. People in offices ordinarily give others the benefit of the doubt when the request appears to be authentic. People, as I had learned at a very young age, are just too trusting. Maybe my venture back into hacking was excusable, or at least understandable, justified by my need to solve the riddle of my half-brother's death. Yet, I suddenly realized I had been beyond stupid. I had been using one of the three phone lines in my dad's apartment to make all kinds of social engineering calls to Pacific Bell, to follow leads in my Adam investigation, and to talk with Lewis. These were all clear violations of my conditions of my supervised release. What if the feds were monitoring my dad's phone lines and had heard those conversations? I needed to find out what they knew. 13. The Wiretapper. Even paranoids sometimes have real enemies. One day, I had a gut feeling that someone was watching me, or rather listening to my phone conversations. The idea had me really fretting. I was panicked about getting a call from my probation officer telling me to come in for one of those visits that would mean I was about to be taken into custody again and shipped back to federal detention, maybe even put back in solitary confinement. Scary as hell. Our home phone service was served out of a Pac Bell central office in Calabasas, which covered a small territory, so if there were any intercepts, I figured I'd likely be the target. I called the CO and got a tech on the line. "Hi," I said. "This is Terry Atchley in security. I think we have some of our equipment over there. We're short on monitoring equipment, and we need some of our boxes back for another case. Could you walk around the frame and see if you have any of them?" The frame tech asked me what they looked like. I didn't know. I stumbled a bit and said, "It depends on the model that's being used over there. It's probably a small box with a miniature printer attached that's recording the digits dialed." He went to look. I was nervous as hell, pacing as I waited for him to come back to the phone. I was praying he wouldn't find anything. Finally, he came back on the line. "Yeah," he said. My heart started beating faster, adrenaline pumping through my veins. "I found three of your boxes. They're small gray boxes, but as far as I could see, they don't have printers," the tech said. Three boxes. Probably one for each of the phone lines at the apartment I was sharing with my dad. Fuck, this was not good. "Okay," I told him. "If we don't still need them there, somebody will come by and pick them up tomorrow. I need you to trace out the connections." "On which one?" "Let's try the first one." The tech asked me which side to trace. Another uh-oh. Again, I didn't know how to answer. He told me the box had two connections. "Let's trace out both and see where they go," I said. After several anxious minutes of waiting, I heard him come back on the line. "I had to trace this thing across the frame," he said. I recognized that for what it was, an annoyed complaint that I had made him chase wires a considerable distance through a complicated maze running along the main distribution frame. He also told me, "On one side I just hear a 1,000-cycle tone." That was weird. "On the other I get a dial tone." But I wouldn't be able to understand how these boxes worked until I knew what they were connected to. I asked him to disconnect the cables from the frame and do an LV, a line verification, to find out what phone numbers were connected to each side of the box. "Okay, give me a few minutes," he said. Doing line verifications was a routine task. The tech would simply lift each cable pair one at a time, clip his lineman's handset to the pair, and dial the code to determine each phone number. The 1,000-cycle tone didn't make sense. Intriguing. I had no idea what it meant, but didn't have time to dwell on the question. My heart was racing. I was sweating with fear, knowing he was going to read me one of my dad's phone numbers. He finally came back on the line and gave me the two phone numbers connected to one of the boxes, neither of them belonging to Dad. I let out a silent sigh. I could finally breathe again. It was as if a ton of bricks had been lifted off my chest. "But what about the other two boxes?" The tech sounded just a bit annoyed when I told him I needed the other two traced as well.
Still, he wasn't going to make trouble for himself by complaining out loud. Though the wait this time was much longer, he finally came back and gave me the numbers that were connected to the other two boxes. Again, none were for any of my dad's lines. No one was checking up on me. I could hardly wait for the next step, calling both numbers assigned to each box. First, I tried one of the 1,000 cycle numbers. It rang 3 times, and then answered with a beep, beep, beep. I tried again and again. No matter what time I called, always the same thing. What could this be? Maybe it was waiting for some type of code. Whatever the explanation, it was obvious to me that it wasn't the line being wiretapped. I was going to enjoy exploring and finding out this number's secret. The other number connected to the first box was answered with just a hello, which had to be the person being intercepted. Just out of curiosity, I called the Mechanized Loop Assignment Center to learn who the unfortunate victim of the intercept was. It wasn't a Mr. or Mrs. somebody. It was a company called Teltech Investigations. I tried the lines on the second box, and then the third. All 3 were for the same company, Teltech Investigations. That evening over dinner, I mentioned to my dad that I had checked to see if our phone lines were being wiretapped. He rolled his eyes. I could imagine what he was thinking. My son must be living in a James Bond fantasy world to think anybody would bother wiretapping him. That's the kind of stuff that only happens in spy movies. I tried to convince him it was a serious possibility, though there was no need to worry. There really were wiretaps in the neighborhood, but they were on some company called Teltech Investigations, not on us. I smiled to let him know there was nothing to be concerned about. He looked at me in surprise.
Teltech?
I nodded. In another of those small world coincidences, my dad knew about Teltech, which he explained was a PI firm, a company employing private investigators and skip tracers who tracked down the assets of business partners who'd squirreled away more than their share of the profits, men who were getting divorced and had tons of cash in hidden bank accounts and so on. And,
I know Mark Kasdan, the manager there, my father told me.
Then he added,
how about if I give him a call? I bet he'll want to know what you found out.
I said, why not? I thought the guy would appreciate the information. 20 minutes later, there was a knock at the apartment door. Kasdan hadn't wasted any time coming over. Dad let him in and introduced us. The guy was short and stocky, but muscled, with a bit of a ponytail that looked like it was maybe meant to distract you from noticing that he was balding on top. He didn't look anything like my idea of a Sam Spade or Anthony Pelicano, though I'd find out later that he was one of those avid Harley owners who talked about their bikes with great affection. And he was always on the hunt for chicks, focused on his next conquest. I looked at this guy and wondered why his firm was being investigated, though I was pretty sure he wasn't going to share anything incriminating with me. I explained I had checked to see if my dad's phone lines were being tapped. They aren't, I told him. But 3 lines at Teltech are being monitored. His reaction was pretty much like my father's. He looked like he was thinking, this kid is full of it. No way he'd be able to find out if a phone line was being wiretapped. I was excited to share my capabilities. It was cool because ordinarily this was stuff you had to keep to yourself unless you wanted to end up in a dormitory at a prison camp. You don't think I could find wiretaps? Just using my computer and any telephone, I can monitor anyone I want. The look on his face said, why am I wasting time with this blowhard? I asked if he wanted a demonstration. He replied with a skeptical, cocky,
sure, let's see if you can listen to my girlfriend's line.
She lived in Agoura Hills, he told me. In my notebook, I had handwritten notes of the dial-up numbers for the SAS Remote Access Test Points, RATPs, in several COs in the San Fernando Valley. I looked up the number for the RATP in the Agoura CO that served her area. There were 4 numbers listed. Since I knew my dad's lines didn't have any intercepts on them, I could use one of them to dial into SAS, because it was a local call. No billing record would be generated, meaning no evidence could be found later showing that anybody had ever dialed SAS from this line. I sat down at a desktop computer, which was actually my friend's, though my dad had agreed to say it was his if a probation officer ever dropped by, since I wasn't supposed to use computers except with prior approval. I used the computer modem to dial into the SAS unit in the Agoura CO. On the second one of my dad's lines, I called another number and put the phone in speakerphone mode. They heard the ring, ring, ring. Then I typed some commands on the computer. All of a sudden, the ringing stopped with a loud click, as if someone had picked up the phone. They watched, intrigued, as I hummed loudly into the speakerphone. Immediately, we heard a series of touch tones, as if someone picked up the line and started to initiate a call. I asked Mark for his girlfriend's phone number as I entered a series of commands on the computer. We were now listening on the girlfriend's phone line. Bummer. She wasn't on the phone. The line was silent. Mark, your girlfriend's not on the line, I told him. Try calling her from your cell phone. As he took out his cell phone and speed dialed the number, my dad was giving me a look of disbelief, as if he were watching some Harry Houdini wannabe trying to perform a magic trick he didn't really know how to do. From the speakerphone on my dad's phone line, we heard the brrr, brrr that meant the phone number was ringing. After four rings, we heard an answering machine pick up, then the girlfriend's outgoing message. Leave a message, I told him with a big grin. As he talked into his cell phone, we could hear his words coming out over my dad's speakerphone. Mark's jaw dropped. His eyes widened and locked on mine with a look of awe and admiration. That's fucking incredible, he said. How did you do that? I replied with what has since become a tired cliché. I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you. On his way out, he said, I think you'll be hearing from me. The idea of working for a PI firm sounded fantastic. Maybe I could learn some great new investigative techniques. I watched him walk out the door and hoped I really would hear from him again. 14. You tap me, I tap you. A couple of days after meeting my father's friend, Mark Kasdan, from the PI firm, I set out on the long drive back to Vegas to pick up my clothes and personal belongings. The probation department had approved my request that I be allowed to move in long-term with my dad. I left my dad's at an early hour that didn't much suit my nocturnal lifestyle, but would let me escape L.A. before the morning rush hour. During the drive, I planned to do a little social engineering to investigate the monitoring boxes I had discovered. The ones I had at first feared were on my dad's phone lines. I turned onto the 101 freeway eastbound toward the I-10, which would take me east through the desert. My cell phone was at hand, as usual cloned to someone else's phone number. A funny thing about the freeway. A few weeks earlier, I had been cut off by a guy driving a BMW. Busy talking on his cell phone, he had suddenly switched lanes, swerving within inches of my car, scaring the crap out of me, and only barely missing wiping out both of us. I'd grabbed my cell phone and made one of my pretexting calls to the DMV, running the BMW's license plate and getting the owner's name and address. Then I called an internal department at Pactel Cellular. Only two cell phone companies serviced Southern California at the time, so I had a 50-50 chance of getting it right the first time. Gave the guy's name and address, and found that, yes, Pactel Cellular had his account. The lady gave me his cell phone number, and hardly more than 5 minutes after the jerk had cut me off, I called and got him on the phone. I was still shaking with anger. I shouted, Hey, you fucking dick, I'm the guy you fucking cut off 5 minutes ago and almost killed us both. I'm from the DMV, and if you pull one more stunt like that, we're going to cancel your driver's license. He must wonder to this day how some other driver on the freeway was able to get his cell phone number. I'd like to think that call scared the shit out of him. Truth be told, though, that lesson in the dangers of using a cell phone while driving didn't have much lasting impact on me, either. Once I had left behind the traffic noises and honking horns of the rush hour freeways and settled in from a drive to Vegas, I was on the phone. My first call was to a number etched in my memory, the one for the Pacific Bell Switching Center that supported all the switches in the West San Fernando Valley area. Canoga Park SCC, this is Bruce, a tech answered. Hi, Bruce, I said. This is Tom Baudette with Engineering in Pasadena. The name I'd given was too familiar at the time. Baudette was an author and actor who'd been doing a series of radio ads for Motel 6, signing off with, This is Tom Baudette, and I'll leave the light on for you. I had just tossed off the first name that came into my head, but Bruce didn't seem to have noticed, so I kept right on. "How's it going?" I asked.
"Fine, Tom. What do you need?"
"I'm working on an unusual case of trouble out of Calabasas. We're getting a high-pitched tone, sounds like a thousand cycles. We're trying to find where the call was originating from. Could you take a look?"
"Sure. What's your callback number?"
Though Bruce hadn't recognized my voice, I sure did know who he was. He'd been the target of social engineering scams by me and other phone freaks for years, and had been stung enough times that he had grown suspicious and protective, so any time he got a call from somebody he didn't know who claimed to be a company employee, he'd ask for a callback number. And it had better be a number he recognized as being internal to Pacific Bell. He'd ring off and dial you back. Most phone freaks either don't bother to set up a callback number or don't know how. They try to get away with some lame-brained excuse like, "I'm just going into a meeting," but Bruce was hip to all of that and he wasn't going to get conned again. So before my call, I had convinced a Pacific Bell employee that I was a company engineer who'd been sent to L.A. to tackle a technical problem and needed a temporary local phone number. Once that was set up, I put it on call forwarding to my cloned cell phone number of the day. When Bruce called back to the legitimate internal phone number I had given him, it rang through to my cell phone.
"Engineering, this is Tom," I answered.
"Tom, this is Bruce calling you back."
"Hey, thanks, Bruce. Could you take a look at this number, 880-0653, in the Calabasas switch, and let me have the origination information?"
In layman's terms, I was asking him to trace the call.
"Yeah, one sec," he said.
I was nervous as hell. If Bruce heard a car horn honking or some other non-office-like background noise, I'd be caught out. This was way too important, way too interesting to screw up. I could hear Bruce typing, and I knew exactly what he was doing, querying the switch to trace the call.
"Tom, okay, the call is coming from the LA-70 tandem," meaning it was a long-distance call coming from outside the LA area. Bruce then gave me the detailed trunking information I needed to continue the trace. I also asked him for the number of the switching center that managed the LA-70 tandem. My uncanny ability to remember telephone numbers came in handy once again. I didn't have to scribble the number down with one hand while steering with the other. In fact, most of the phone numbers and people's names in this audiobook are the real thing, still imprinted in my memory from as much as 20 years ago. At the end of the call, I told him,
"Don't forget me, Bruce. I'll likely need your help again."
I was hoping he'd remember me the next time and not feel he needed to do that whole call-back routine again. When I called the switching center, the phone was answered.
"LA-70, this is Mary."
I said, "Hey, Mary, this is Carl Randolph from Engineering in San Ramon. I have a circuit I'm tracing, and it appears to originate from your office." Apparently, I was on solid ground all around since Mary didn't hesitate, asking me for the trunking information. I gave it to her, and she put me on hold while she checked. Since phone freaks rarely targeted toll switches, she didn't even bother to verify my identity. Mary came back on the line.
"Carl, I've traced the trunk information you gave me. The call originated from the San Francisco 4E.
She gave me the trunking and the network information she had found from her trace. I also asked her for the number for that 4E office, which she was kind enough to look up for me. I was now approaching Interstate 15. My route would take me through the Cajon Pass, running between the San Bernardino Mountains and the San Gabriel Mountains, making it likely that any call would be dropped. I would wait until I reached Victorville on the far side of the pass. In the meantime, I switched on the car radio and was treated to some favorite oldies from the 50s.
"K-Earth 101," the disc jockey said. "We're giving away $1,000 an hour to lucky caller number 7 after you hear the K-Earth jingle. The best oldies on the radio."
Wow. Wouldn't it be cool to win a grand? But why even bother trying? I had never won any contest I had ever entered. Still, the idea planted itself in my mind and would eventually turn from a fantasy into a temptation. As I approached Victorville, I dialed the number Mary had given me, reaching a guy who said his name was Omar.
"Hey, Omar, this is Tony Howard with ESAC in Southern California," I said. "We have a weird situation here. We were tracing a circuit, and it has a 1,000-cycle tone on it."
I gave him the trunking information from the LA tandem, and he went off to check. Leaving Victorville, I was now heading back into an empty stretch of desert and again concerned that the cell call might drop. I slowed down from my open road speed of 80 miles an hour so I wouldn't leave Victorville behind quite so quickly. It was some time before Omar came back on the line.
"I heard that high-pitched tone," he said, and went "ee" in imitation of the sound, which made me chuckle to myself. I had heard the tone, and I didn't really need to hear his attempt to duplicate it. He told me the call was originating from Oakland.
"Cool," I said. "Thank you, that's a help. Give me the trunking information from your switch so we can trace it." He queried the switch and gave me the info.
My next call was to the Oakland Switching Control Center.
"We're trying to trace a call from the San Francisco 4E, I said, and provided the trunking and network information. The tech put me on hold, then came back and gave me a 510-2083-XXX number. I had now traced the call all the way to its origin. This was the phone number dialing out to one of the boxes in the Calabasas CO that was wiretapping Teltec. I still wanted to know if that thousand-cycle tone would ever change. If it did, what would happen? Would I hear a data signal? Would I hear a phone conversation? I called Omar back. "Hey, has anything changed with that tone?" He answered that he had listened to it for about 15 minutes and never heard any change. I asked, "Is it possible to put the handset near the speaker so I can hear the tone? I want to run some tests." He said he'd put the phone down next to the speaker and I could just hang up when I was done. This was awesome. With that tone coming through to my cell phone, it was almost like the time I'd eavesdropped on the eavesdroppers at the NSA. I was wiretapping the wiretap. How ironic was that? By now I was feeling nervous and excited at the same time. But holding the phone to my ear throughout this hours-long social engineering session had given me an earache, and my arm was getting pretty sore as well. As I was entering the stretch of desert leading into Barstow, the halfway point to Las Vegas, where the cell coverage was crappy, the call dropped.
Damn!
I called Omar back, and he set up the connection again so I could keep listening to that thousand-cycle tone over his loudspeakers. I was hoping the tone would end at some point and I would hear something that would give me some clue to what was going on, what the tone signified. Coming into view was a complex that served all the good buddy truckers who drove 18-wheelers all day and all night. I pulled in to fill the gas tank of the car and then decided to check up on my dad, who was still suffering over Adam's death. With my cell phone tied up with the intercept, I found a payphone to make the call to my dad. I dialed his number and held on while the phone rang. The high-pitched tone from the cell phone suddenly stopped.
What the hell?
I grab the cell phone and hold it to my other ear. My dad's voice comes over the payphone receiver as he answers, "Hello?" I hear him over the payphone and at the same time over the cell phone.
Fuck! I can't believe this! This intercept isn't on Teltec anymore. It's on my dad's phone. The tap has been moved. They're intercepting us. Oh, shit.
I try to sound calm but assertive, insistent. "Dad, I need you to go over to the payphone at the village market across the street. I have some important news about Adam," I tell him. My wording has to be innocuous, something that won't tip off the intercept listener.
"Kevin, what's going on?" Dad says, angry at me. "I'm tired of these stupid James Bond games."
I insist and finally manage to convince him. I'm sweating. How long have they been intercepting my calls without my knowing? A thousand questions are running through my mind. Was Teltec really a target, or was it an elaborate scheme concocted by Pacific Bell Security to trick me? A way of social engineering the hacker? My heart is racing as I try to recall everything I said and did on the phone from my dad's house. What did they hear? How much do they know? After 5 minutes, I call the payphone at the market. "Dad," I tell him, "get the fucking computer out of the house. You need to do it now. Don't wait. Those wiretaps, they're not on Teltec anymore. Those guys are listening to us. You gotta get the computer out right away. Please." He agrees, but sounds really pissed. My next call is to Lewis with the same message. "We gotta go into cleanup mode." We agree we'll each stash our notes and floppy disks in places where no one will be able to find them. Let the government try to prosecute. No evidence, no case. I arrive at my mom's place in Las Vegas with my nerves shot. I kept obsessively playing over and over in my mind all the conversations they might have intercepted. What if they'd heard me discussing SAS with Lewis? What if they had heard me social engineering internal Pacific Bell departments? Just imagining either of those possibilities was giving me heartburn. I was half expecting the U.S. Marshals and my probation officer to show up at my door and arrest